Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
I often refer to the Damien Heard case as the story I can't get out of my head. I've been reporting on it for over 6 years, and in that time, I've spoken with dozens of witnesses, experts, and fellow journalists about the dynamics of Damien's final days on Earth. When I talk about Damien's disappearance and death, I'm usually asked what I truly think happened to the college freshman. It's a question I've wrestled with for longer than I ever imagined. And yes, I have developed my own theories on what happened to Damien Heard and who, if anyone, is responsible. From Cold Case Productions, this is Final Days on Earth, The Life and Death of Damien Heard. Episode 12, Alternate Theories. I'm your host, Claire Sanima. Thanks for listening. Just a quick note that this episode contains graphic descriptions and language. Audience discretion is advised. When you study a case as long as I have with Damien's, your Rolodex of sources gets pretty thick. In this episode, we'll meet a few new people, including former professional wrestler Chris Nowinski, who co-founded a brain injury research center.
When you change your brain, you change who you are.
And Zach Sorensen, a friend of Damien's at Western, who the police never contacted.
Everyone in that town, every student knew that Damien got killed at that party.
We'll also catch up with some old favorites, like Damien's wrestling teammate, Ryan Pello.
When you come out from being knocked out cold and you're trying to fight people, that means that, you know, you probably got your bell rung a little too hard.
And of course, Damien's dad, Gary Heard.
Maybe it pans out to where there is some physical evidence, there is some irrefutable evidence, some sort of proof that Damien took his own life.
One of my favorite sounding boards for theories about Damien is my partner in Cold Case Productions, Sharon Richards. Sharon recruited me to the podcast world after reading a magazine article I'd written called The ESD Sex Scandal. The story chronicled a teacher's continued abuse of a teenage girl at an elite private school in Dallas. We ultimately decided Damien's story was better suited for podcast, and we've been discussing the Colorado case ever since.
And then here's another thing I keep thinking about. If you were going to hang yourself, having the noose around the outside of the sweatshirt almost seems like a compassionate thing to do, right? But if you were really going to kill yourself, wouldn't you be concerned that that might, like, break your fall and not work? I guess for me, if I were contemplating suicide, I guess the fear of failure would be worse than the fear of pain.
Yeah. The defense boils down to, you know, a lot of times for it being a suicide, whenever they can't explain anything, what they say is, well, suicide is an irrational act. And so it's not rational what they do, how they end up there, what method they use, you know, where they are. It's never rational because suicide is irrational.
I don't think I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it is, but I think in other times, whether it's rational or not, it's oftentimes really premeditated.
As we were honing in on Damien's story for podcast, Sharon brought up a similar case of a young wrestler who died by hanging while a student at Wagner College in New York. A 2008 article in the Staten Island Advocate reads, "Student's death stuns Wagner College." His friends went on to describe the 20-year-old as, quote, "the last person they would have ever pegged as depressed." It was incredible to me that another young wrestler had died in a similar circumstance when it had originally seemed so bizarre and remote. I started wondering if there was a connection between wrestlers and suicide that I'd been missing. This is Damien's college teammate, Francisco Marquez, talking to Gunnison police shortly after his friend's mysterious death.
I know, like, a lot of people are saying, like, a lot of the signs don't lead up to what happened, but, you know, a lot of the cases, you know, I had a friend that ended up committing suicide on my wrestling team my senior year.
I've played a variety of sports my entire life, and I never knew a single athlete who committed suicide. But examples of wrestlers who took their own life just kept coming up. I started looking into risk factors and patterns for wrestlers and suicide. And simply by following the story, I came across something quite unexpected. A 2015 study in the American Journal of Sports Medicine looked at data from NCAA athletic trainers over a 5-year period. It concluded that college wrestlers had the highest concussion rates of any amateur athletes. I was pretty surprised by this finding, because typically the conversation about concussions focuses on football players, not wrestlers. Extensive research about football players' concussions have proven that repeated head injuries can have catastrophic results for mental and physical health.
CT is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a neurodegenerative brain disease that all evidence says is caused by repeated brain trauma.
According to experts, suicide is the leading cause of death for those with early stages of CTE. While you probably recognize that acronym today from the NFL's concussion protocols, it wasn't always part of the sports world's vocabulary. A big reason that it is at all is because of Chris Nowinski, a former college football player and one-time professional wrestler for WWE. Nowinski is also a proud Harvard graduate.
I had a blast until I got kicked in the head too many times and had to retire from post-concussion syndrome.
Chris said he used to hide his injuries.
And I lied about how bad I was feeling, that the symptoms wouldn't, the headaches, the sleep problems, the nausea when I got my heart rate up, none of that would go away for weeks, but I kept wrestling because I thought that's what you're supposed to do, you know, be tough.
Today, Chris is the co-founder and CEO of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at Boston University. We spoke in July 2020, about a week after I came home from my trip to Gunnison, Colorado.
A lot of people that are rough and tumble, they don't realize it might actually not just be a bump on the head or, you know, seeing stars like in the cartoons, like you could actually do real damage.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, athletes are all taught that if you can continue to compete, you should. If we don't actually teach our children what concussions are, they will never know, and they will never tell us when they have these experiences, because the experiences just seem normal to a child. You know, you get hit in the head, of course your head's going to hurt. You get hit in the head and you can't see for a while, and then it comes back. Well, if it comes back before you see an adult, why would you tell them about that time where you had ringing in your ears or double vision, like, because it's irrelevant once you've recovered, and that those things recover usually quickly.
One blow to the head won't trigger CTE, but repeated head injuries can, especially those left undiagnosed and untreated.
And we don't know for each individual how many blows to the head will trigger the disease, just like for any individual, we don't know how many cigarettes you can smoke before you get lung cancer.
In 2006, Chris Nowinski authored Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis from the NFL to Youth Leagues. He highlighted damning evidence from Dr. Bennett Omalu about the cause and effect of CTE. Nowinski's controversial book was not immediately well received.
When the book came out, a book on complex neuroscience written by a professional wrestler didn't exactly fly off the shelves. I struggled to get the people to care about it. And the news to cover it.
Those blowing the whistle on head injuries in football were up against a billion-dollar industry that saw CTE as the enemy and a threat to the future of the sport. The NFL poured money and resources into its Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee, which pumped out research alleging that concussions were minor injuries without proof of lasting effects. But 1 month after Nowinski's book came out, a high-profile suicide of a retired NFL player shocked the football community. Former Philadelphia Eagle Andre Waters was only 44 years old when he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in November 2006. Nowinski helped get a sample of Waters' brain tissue to Dr. Amelou, who diagnosed the NFL star with CTE. The New York Times ran the story on its front page. It was the beginning of a new storyline on the complex world of sports head injuries.
Players started coming out of the woodwork, you know, letting me know about their problems and their struggles. And I said, this is how we're going to get people to care. And so I created the foundation to be a way to formalize and continue the process of outreach to families, with the goal of partnering with the best scientists I could find that really wanted to take on this challenge of what's going on, and also the politics of the issue, because of course the NFL wasn't pleased about this work being done, and they charted out a lot of scientists to say this wasn't real.
Nowinski co-founded the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy with Dr. Ann McKee at Boston University in 2008. But it would take several more years before CTE was truly legitimized. By 2012, the NFL's response to head injuries was on the ropes.
Tonight on Frontline, the epic story of football's concussion crisis.
We don't know if concussion in and of itself is what causes the abnormalities.
A decades-long battle between scientists, players, and the nation's most powerful sports league.
We strongly deny those allegations that we withheld any information or misled the players.
In the years following Nowinski's book, Head Games, there were a number of high-profile suicides by NFL players.
The tragedy of Dave Durson, the possibility of CTE.
One of the best NFL players of his generation has died. Junior Seau apparently committed suicide today. And that is again raising questions about the toll taken by heavy-hitting sports.
The NFL instituted new concussion protocols in 2013. And settled a $765 million lawsuit with retired players. In 2015, Will Smith played Dr. Bennett Amelou in the movie Concussion, bringing the CTE conversation fully mainstream, at least for football players. Remember the study I told you about at the beginning of this episode? The one that got me started down the CTE path as a potential component of Damien's story? That 2015 study in the American Journal of Sports Medicine concluded that college wrestlers have the highest concussion rate of any amateur athletes. Considering wrestlers' high concussion rate, I wondered why football players were at the forefront of the conversation about CTE. So I asked Chris Nowinski about it.
There's no question amateur wrestlers take considerable blows to the head, have a very high concussion rate relative to other sports. And the highest concussion rate in some studies, and also take repetitive brain trauma. So I wouldn't be surprised at all that we'll find more amateur wrestlers with CTE. They're just, you know, there aren't that many amateur wrestlers in America anymore. We just don't have the cases.
That makes sense. That would be a big reason why you aren't able to quantify it. You know, you would need people to donate. To donate brains, former wrestlers, is that really the only way to measure it?
Right now, for CTE, yes, we would need the brains.
Nowinski says there's not currently a reliable method to test for CTE in living people. It's only possible to diagnose after death by taking a sample of brain tissue. And since there are far more people playing football in America than there are wrestling, the majority of samples come from football players. I wanted to learn more about CTE and to look at Damien's life and death through the lens of possibly having an undiagnosed brain injury. I found an article written by attorney Gordon Johnson for StopCTE.org about the connection between violence, depression, and brain disease. Johnson wrote, "During the early stages of CTE, severe depression and suicide are among the most common features. CTE is the perfect storm for suicide, as it synergistically combines the following traits in a despondent individual. Depression, anxiety, paranoia, reduced impulse control, behavioral extremes that can often be violent, and despair." I told Nowinski about Damien's background, the fact that he'd wrestled since he was 4 years old, and that in the days leading up to his death, his behavior had included aggressive, impulsive decisions and increased drug use. His fight with Anthony Rios and the fact that Damien might have been using acid for the first time especially stood out to me.
So when I look at the different side effects of brain trauma, I start to see how he, you know, potentially fits that profile. Of course, kids in college do a lot of these things without having, you know, brain damage, so you have to acknowledge that as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a lot in his story that is consistent with other people with which we've diagnosed the CTE.
Yeah, it's kind of been like this light bulb moment for me as I've gone through this. Wow, could this help explain some of these things that seemed like anomalies, you know? People talked about him, Damien, you know, being the nicest kid and the happiest kid, and then you talk about, you know, the months and weeks leading up to this event, and they say, well, he started to get in a lot of fights. He punched a refrigerator. That was weird. You know, they remembered him doing these really aggressive, violent things that he normally did not do outside of, you know, the wrestling gym. And so that started, all those little things started to sort of stick out in my mind as, well, maybe he wasn't, you know, himself at this time in his life.
Right. A lot of those things would also coincide with, like, major life events, like, you know, someone died or this or that. But in the absence of that, you know, some of it can be just organic brain damage.
Yeah, there was nothing going on, major developments in his life at this time. It was like second semester, freshman year, it seemed like everything was going pretty well. He, you know, the only other event is that he had recently broken up with a girlfriend. That is true. She had broken up with him. He was talking to other girls, and, you know, some people said, like, oh, he wasn't, you know, he was totally over it. He was dating this other girl. And other people said, like, oh, no, he was still in love with her, and, you know, he wasn't over it. But it's hard with young kids and dating. I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time, and plenty of people get broken up with every day and don't commit suicide. So it's like anything else, you know, you have to take it all with a grain of salt. But it definitely, that was the only other sort of life event, if you can call it that, that was taking place around that same time.
Yeah, fascinating. I remember all the toughest football players I played with were all high school wrestlers. If I think about my teammates who were state champions in high school wrestling, they were the killers.
That's great. Yeah, that's what Damien was. Yeah, he was a state champion wrestler, and he fought really hard to obviously get that title. And so he definitely was not somebody who ever backed down or ever quit.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's made the idea of him committing suicide so hard for anyone to comprehend. You know, it just doesn't seem... Everyone has said, like, it's just not something they ever thought, you know, about whenever they thought about him.
Yeah, no, I understand that. You know, the third brain I ever acquired or studied for our team was a friend of mine who I'd known for 5 years, who I worked with at WWE.
Nowinski is talking about former professional wrestler Chris Benoit, who committed suicide by hanging in 2007 after murdering his wife and son. When doctors examined his brain tissue, they found evidence of advanced CTE.
And I knew him as a great guy. And so when we found out he had severe disease, you know, it put those acts, you know, in some context for me, because I couldn't imagine that person that I knew for those years doing something like that in the absence of brain damage.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really, really good point. Think about any type of disease, how much it changes, you know, who the person is that you know, who they are without the disease and who they are with it. You know, it can help explain sort of the unexplainable.
Your brain is who you are. Your brain is your personality. Your brain is your behavior. Your brain is everything you say and do. And so when you change your brain, you change who you are.
In all my interviews with Damien's friends and family, stories of a head injury never came up. This is one of Damien's high school coaches, Chris Allen.
I mean, a lot of times if he was injured, I mean, he would wrestle hurt. But I mean, with me, he never really had any kind of serious injuries or anything of that nature. I mean, we had to deal with the leg for a little bit, and we just kind of worked through it. Would take some time off here and there, but, I mean, it didn't really affect him. I mean, he was a tough kid, and a lot of times there's no telling how many different little things that happen when you're kind of banged up as a wrestler that he probably just wrestled with and you never even knew he had.
And what about, like, concussions? Is that common in wrestling?
Those happen sometimes, yes.
But you don't have any specific memories of anything like that with Damien?
I mean, if we did, then it was a short stint, and we went through the concussion protocol, because there in ASA we had the CTE concussion protocol.
Concussion protocol in Texas high school athletics was formalized in 2011 and outlines prevention, treatment, and oversight of concussions for all student athletes. Texas coaches were required to undergo training by 2012. Damien graduated from Fossil Ridge High School 1 year later, in 2013. I asked Damien's father, Gary Hurd, if he remembered his son having a head injury.
I don't remember any one particular instance that's like, oh yeah, he's got a concussion. But like any wrestler, like anybody in a combat sport, when you get slammed around or you're going to get mild concussions. No different than a kid in a practice in football. Can't hit your head and think that nothing's going to happen. Just because you weren't knocked out doesn't mean you weren't concussed. I would imagine that many, many, many times over the years, he probably had concussions.
But like you said, he never acted concussed to the point where, like, you felt like he should take some time off or anything like that?
Oh, no. No, not at all. No, because we would have, if that would have been the case. If there had been any kind of indication that memory loss, memory lapse, motor skills, anything like that, absolutely, we would have pulled him, for sure. And I had many wrestlers that I've coached over the years that have been knocked out or concussed on the mat, and, you know, we went through the protocol.
That was just something I came across, that wrestlers had a high concussion rate. In some studies, they even say higher than football players, and I wasn't aware of that, and so that kind of sent me down, you know, one of those paths like I was talking about. If he had had undiagnosed concussions, untreated concussions, and, you know, potentially caused some brain damage and, you know, maybe put him in a place where he was not thinking clearly or thinking, you know, normal Damien thoughts.
Nobody there, teammate, coaches, team trainers, nobody ever gave me any indication that he had had a concussion or got a concussion, and he didn't either. And we talked about everything.
Damien's college wrestling teammate, Ryan Pello, didn't specifically remember Damien having any head injuries.
People are always kind of getting dinged up and stuff like that.
Ryan says if Damien ever did have a concussion, it was never an obvious one.
I never saw any kind of those situations where, you know, Damien got knocked out cold and was just, you know, acting concussed.
Yeah, I mean, are concussions pretty common in wrestling or not so common?
I don't know. I guess I really don't have, like, any statistics in front of me.
I mean, just in your experience. Really, yeah, in your experience.
In my experience, I mean, I've never had one or anything. I've seen teammates and stuff that have had it. Nothing sticks out of my mind of, like, crazy story of, like, a different guy on the team when he got knocked out. And it was like, he got up and he was, like, so out of it, they tried to, like, fight the ref for some reason. That guy definitely had a concussion.
Right.
Like, when you come out from being knocked out cold and you're trying to, like, you know, fight people, that means that, you know, you probably got your bell rung a little too hard, you know.
So you've seen that happen? You've seen people do that? Or you're just giving a hypothetical?
No, I mean, I've seen that happen. I mean, you see that sometimes, you know, when a guy gets knocked out, they come back to it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, even, like, in the UFC fights and stuff like that, those guys get knocked out and they just, like, you know, they turn on some fight or flight kind of instincts and they just go do weird things. Because I think there's only, like, two moments in my life where I've seen, like, in wrestling, where I've seen, like, yeah, that guy definitely has a concussion for teammates. One was that kind of thing that happened, which was just kind of weird. And the other one was, like, the guy just started bawling his eyes out as soon as he came out. Like, he was just crying for no reason. Like,
oh, wow.
But those were, like, 12 years. And, you know, in football, I saw a lot worse kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Contact sports, freak accidents happen. I'm sure those people are fine now.
In my research on CTE and its possible connection to wrestling, I came across another case from 2014 involving a college wrestler and football player named Costa Karageorge. The parallels with Damien's story jumped out at me. This is a quote from an article in the New York Times. On the last night of Karageorge's life, he went to a party with his girlfriend and a football teammate. I found out that, like Damien, Karageorge was also missing for 4 days before his body was found in an unusual location. Karageorge was inside a dumpster with a single gunshot wound to the head. But there are also several stark differences when comparing Costa Karageorge's death to Damien Hurd's. Karageorge had reported 15 concussions in his career as a wrestler and a football player. In the hours before his death, Karageorge sent goodbye texts to his loved ones. His brain tissue was sent to Boston University, where Dr. Ann McKee diagnosed the 22-year-old with stage 1 CTE. Here again is Chris Nowinski.
We have a brain bank full of these stories.
CTE can affect people of all ages.
For the young people, we do find CTE in about half. And then the other ones, you know, we may not find CTE, but we do find brain damage, some measure of brain damage in most. Whether or not it was the cause of their demise, you know, we can't say, but families are very good at guessing when they've lost a loved one that they had CTE.
Damien's dad, Gary, doesn't think his son had an undiagnosed brain injury, but he is open to exploring all the possibilities.
I've always said that, give me something, give me some evidence, give me something physical, give me something tangible that says my son was in that state of mind and wasn't able to get himself out of it and succumb to that way of thinking and ended his own life. I'm not a psychic. I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't in my son's head in those last moments.
But what if there was a way to get into Damien's head and see what was going on? That's what Chris Nowinski and Dr. Ann McKee try to do with their brain bank at Boston University.
The science is getting better. This exposure to repetitive hits to the head can cause breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, inflammation in the brain, and scientists believe that's directly correlated to the physics of a rapidly twisting brain, where that's where the most strain and stress will go onto neurons and axons and cause physical damage.
I wondered if Damien's case could possibly fit the bill for examination at the brain bank.
Damien died in 2014. He was embalmed, buried. I know that they took brain tissue, you know, during the autopsy, but it's been so long at this point. I know whenever I look back at the literature, like for him, they said that they would keep the samples for 2 years, but we're well beyond that.
Looked into it?
I wasn't able to get any answers whenever I called and tried to find out if they still had the samples. But is that what you would need? You would need the brain tissue sample?
Correct. I just had this conversation 2 weeks ago with another family with another high-profile suicide, but we're going back and getting tissue.
Something I never imagined, if we could actually know that. That would be really helpful.
My main hope is that we get to the truth, and what I believe to be the truth, we'll see. We'll see if that's what it pans out to be.
Yeah.
And it may not. You know, and maybe it pans out to where there is some physical evidence, there is some irrefutable evidence, some sort of proof that Damien took his own life. And yeah, that's going to suck to try to swallow that, for sure. But it sucks to try to swallow the fact that he's just not here. Doesn't matter how he left.
But if brain damage was a factor in Damien's death, that's something that could matter to all the young wrestlers following in his footsteps, including Damien's little brother, Nathaniel.
I told him no at first. You know, I wanted to wait a couple more years, but he just kept on me and kept on me and kept on me. 3 years later, he's still at it. At the point now where he's taken second at big national tournaments, making it to the finals of these big tournaments, and going down the same exact path that Damien went down.
At 8 years old, Nathaniel Hurd is on his way to becoming one of the top youth wrestlers in Texas.
Every coach that comes in and out of there, all the parents, everybody says the same thing about Nathaniel, which is mentally, that's the strongest kid they've ever seen, and which is exactly the same things I heard about Damian. You know, the kid is just so mentally strong, and he doesn't cry, he doesn't boo-hoo. When the practices get rough, he embraces it. He embraces that grind. He knows it's making him better, and he wants to get better. So he's willing to sacrifice pain. He's willing to sacrifice to get there. A carbon copy of Damian.
That's got to be just a sight to behold.
And it's bittersweet for me, knowing how Damian's career ended and how his life ended. It's bittersweet, you know. And I was definitely more on Damian as he got older, as far as performance goes, and with Nathaniel, given how Damian's life turned out, I'm the exact opposite. I'll motivate him, but never in a way that I'm disappointed in him. I never show any disappointment.
I could feel the pain in Gary's voice, and the second guessing that he was doing was heartbreaking.
It sounds like maybe you have some, like maybe you're thinking differently about things. And in everything in everything I've ever read and heard and seen, I mean, there was no doubt that Damian knew how much you loved him and supported him, and you know,
for sure.
I don't think there's any, you know, regret you should have in that.
Yeah, I don't have any major regret. I can think back of a couple of times to where things got heated, probably junior high age, something like that. Big, massive national tournament, lots of pressure on everybody, and I was stern with him on some things, but it was never a situation to where our relationship was jeopardized or anything like that.
I always said I would follow the story wherever it led, and I believe the CTE theory is a viable path to better understanding Damian's death. But it's far from the only one I'm following. Because even if Damian had an undiagnosed brain injury, that doesn't explain what happened after his death. The ID card swipes, the movement of his SUV, and the people at the scene with his body. When I talked to former Denver Police Lieutenant Matthew Murray in episode 10 about his expert report, he acknowledged that the only homicide theory that couldn't be disproved by the physical evidence was the idea that Damian was placed in a sleeper hold and rendered unconscious before his death. If you recall, Murray took plenty of issue with the idea of staging a hanging afterward, but more on that later. In January 2021, as I was putting together this final episode, there was a news story that caught my eye. It was about the 2017 death of an Army Green Beret at the hands of Navy SEALs.
34-year-old Staff Sergeant Logan Melgar was found dead on June 4th. He was reportedly strangled in embassy housing in the capital of Mali. Navy investigators have taken over the case to see if the SEALs had any connection to his death.
The CBS News report went on to give more disturbing details about Melgar's final night on Earth.
An autopsy ruled his death a homicide, reportedly by asphyxiation. A law enforcement source says the two Navy SEALs had been involved in an argument with him and are now under investigation by the Naval Criminal Investigative Service.
It's a pretty horrific story, and the kind of thing you'd never believe if someone hadn't confessed to it outright. But that's exactly what happened 3 years after Melgar's death. Chief Petty Officer Tony DeDolph, a member of SEAL Team 6, pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter on January 14, 2021. DeDolph told a judge that the SEALs were, quote, trying to teach Melgar a lesson. DeDolph said the idea started off as a joke, but the talk escalated through the night. It was more like a pack mentality, a group decision, DeDolph said. Around 5 a.m., the SEALs busted into Melgar's room and put him in a rear naked choke that rendered him unconscious. Melgar never woke up. It's unclear exactly what the SEALs did next, but DeDolph also pleaded guilty to conspiracy and obstruction of justice for trying to cover up the cause of Melgar's death. I was struck by the similarities to Damien's final night on Earth. A late-night argument, a rough-and-tumble group of guys, and a mysterious death by asphyxiation that took years of dogged investigating before the truth came out. If we play out the theory that Damien died accidentally at the wrestler's party, then we still have to get him to Cabin Creek. Considering it was the middle of the night, with freezing rain coming down, I think it's reasonable to assume that no one would have tried to move Damien's body until the next morning. Because of my work as a producer for the crime show 48 Hours on CBS, I've learned a lot about the anatomy of death. There's something called postmortem lividity, which is the settling of blood under the influence of gravity, or in layman's terms, how to tell what position a person died in. I reached out to a trusted expert in complicated homicide cases from Texas, and he agreed to look at the autopsy and scene photos for me. He said that in Damien's case, the lividity showed his body standing upright, with blood pooling in his feet and blanching in the parts of his legs that were touching the rock. You can even see the impression from his wallet in his back pocket. From this physical evidence, the expert said it appeared Damien died in that hanging position. But here's the rub. Lividity doesn't become fixed until 8 to 12 hours after death. So if Damien's body was moved multiple times in the hours between 1:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m., there wouldn't necessarily be evidence to show it. We know that Damien was alive at 1:36 a.m. on March 30th when he left City Market gas station. What he did and where he went for the next 12 hours is still a mystery. But by 10 a.m., hiker Linda Nienhauser sees Damien's car at Cabin Creek, and she first remembers seeing his body on the ridge at 1 p.m.
On that ridge there, it looked like a person standing up, camouflage jacket, you know, and I thought this person was looking my direction, and I thought I saw another individual squatted down to the right of that.
The first time I talked to you, you said you thought they might be looking through binoculars?
Yeah. There were two bicycles tied to that post when I was going in.
To me, the biggest missing piece of the puzzle is the identity of the people who Linda saw at Cabin Creek with Damien's body. Considering she saw a white truck and two bicycles with fresh tracks in the snow, I think the most logical conclusion is that two people were there with Damien's body on Sunday, March 30th, 2014. If you recall, Murray said that he felt it would have been nearly impossible for only one person to have put Damien's body in a noose. And he also said he had never witnessed or investigated a suicide where other parties were present.
The victim's car was the only vehicle at the scene. If this were a homicide, then there would have to be a second vehicle, or the murderer killed the victim and then left his vehicle to walk back to town. If there was a second vehicle, then the killer and the victim would have had to travel to a remote location via separate cars, or numerous parties were involved in the plot, and then the killer left the victim and his vehicle.
Because the medical examiner didn't attempt to determine a time of death, we don't know if Damien died closer to when he got gas at 1:30 a.m. or if it occurred sometime in the next 12 hours when Linda reported her sighting at Cabin Creek. As the saying goes, dead men tell no tales, and it occurred to me that having access to Damien's cell phone would be the next best thing to talking to him. After Gunnison police closed the investigation into Damien's death, his dad, Gary, requested all the physical evidence be released to him.
They finally did send it to me, and I've got it here, and it's as it was when I received it. I haven't touched it other than to put it up where it's at now. It has not been touched in all these years. It's still sealed exactly the same way that Gunnison PD sealed it before they mailed it to me.
Have you ever thought about opening it?
Every day. Every day.
What stopped you?
Just wanting it to be untouched. I understand that chain of custody has been broke once they mailed it. I understand all that. But I also understand that any person looking at that could tell that that box has not been opened. It's the same way that I received it. Just in the event there is something in there that was overlooked or might have a fingerprint or DNA or something on it, like his cell phone supposed to be in there. So just not knowing, you know, where the case was going to end up going, I just didn't feel like it was beneficial for me to open it. I mean, if I felt like it was going to be opened and anything in there having a chance in hell of it being admittable into court, then it obviously I could not open that box.
That's pretty serious self-control there, Gary.
Yep, I wanted that phone out of there so bad because I have law enforcement friends. I gave it to them. I wanted to look at it, see what they could come up with.
Gunnison police excerpted many of Damien's text messages and call logs in their report, but the full contents of his cell phone were not included. This is not unusual considering the sheer volume of information that we keep on our phones. It's not practical for police to include everything, especially in a case that is ruled non-criminal. But I knew, in order to make those excerpts, detectives had access to Damien's full cell phone history. So in 2019, I did a second public records request for files in Damien's case from the Gunnison Police Department. That's when I got my hands on Damien's cell phone data dump. It's 6,466 pages detailing every image, message, video, phone call, and contact on Damien's Samsung Galaxy S2 when police found it on April 2, 2014. One of the enduring mysteries about Damien's case is what happened to the text messages between Damien and Anthony Rios. The thread simply doesn't exist on Damien's phone. The only reason we know what was said is because Anthony shared the texts with Gunnison police after Damien's body was found. The forensic report from Damien's phone is supposed to show deleted messages, but there's no message history between Damien and Anthony Rios at all. Since I knew the content of those text messages, I decided to do a search for the exact phrase that Damien used when he wrote Anthony on March 29th. I wanted to see if I could shake loose any leads. I didn't find any texts that appeared to have been sent to Anthony, but I did find something else. At 11:33 p.m., Damien texted the address to the Wrestler's house, 620 North Taylor Street, to a contact simply listed as Zach, WSCU, in his phone. It's the exact phrase Damien also sent to Anthony Rios about half an hour earlier that night. I'd never heard of a second Zach in the Gunnison police report. Only wrestler Zach Shank was interviewed by detectives. So in January 2021, I dialed up the mystery Zach to see what I could learn from him.
Hey, you just gave me a call?
Yeah, is this Zach?
Yeah, what's going on?
I explained what I was doing with the podcast and how I came across his number. Zach was officially intrigued.
I did talk to him that night, and I was like, damn, man, like, I wondered if I was going to get questioned by anyone or anything about anything, and I never did.
Yeah.
This is the first time I'd ever heard from anyone about the whole situation, which was kind of crazy.
Zach was happy to provide information to me, including his last name, Sorensen. He said he met Damien at a party earlier in the semester, and they became fast friends, working out and smoking weed together regularly.
Did you see him that night? Did you go to that party?
I was not there, no. I just heard rumors and records of what had happened there.
Okay. Because one of the last text messages that he sent was to you, and he sent just the address, 620 North Taylor. He just sent that to you at like 11:30 p.m. And I didn't know if you got that message, if you came to the party, you know, came to the house after getting that address, or if you remembered anything about that.
I don't remember that, him sending me that address, but that's crazy.
Big part of the confusion in Damien's case is just the timeline, because it's, you know, not only what happened in the days and hours leading up to his disappearance and death, but what happened afterwards that makes it, you know, so interesting and still has a lot of mystery, you know, attached to it.
Everyone in that town, every student knew that Damien got killed at that party by some wrestlers, and they fucking made it look like he committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
Like, everyone fucking knew about it. Like, I don't know if I'm the first one to tell you this, but, like, everyone knows that that dude was murdered and that the whole city fucking threw it under the rug and fucking made it seem like it was a suicide and didn't want the school or wrestling team to look bad, and, like, it was a complete fucking shit show cover-up.
Wow. Well, you're the first person to actually verbalize that to me. I mean, I'd heard rumors, I'd heard other people say that, I'd heard Damien's family say that, but you're the first person from Western to actually put it all out like that.
After all these years of reporting on Damien's case, it was incredible to hear Zach's description of what he believed happened to his friend. I asked Zach if he remembered any more details about the alleged murder and cover-up.
Damien got in a fight with one of these dudes and, like, put him in a chokehold or something, or they were wrestling around. Damien got, like, definitely, like, manhandled by one of these dudes, and probably, I can't remember the name, but he definitely probably accidentally, like, fucking killed him. Like, but there's definitely rumors of people saying that, like, they, like, he was, like, wrestling around, they took him into, a back room.
At this point, someone in the background started talking. Zach told me it was his girlfriend, Alexis, who was from Gunnison.
I'm going to put you on speakerphone really quick.
Okay.
Alright, say what you said.
Everyone at the party said that he got into a fight and there was three wrestlers that ended up passing out, and they were dragging him to the laundry room, and then they said that he left. And so that's what everybody at the party was told, is that, oh yeah, he just left. But the three wrestlers had dragged him into the laundry room after he had passed out from being in a chokehold.
It's important to note that Alexis herself did not attend the party. She's repeating information she heard secondhand from friends who did.
I've heard versions of that, but I don't know if you've heard this or not, but I know this for sure because I've seen the video surveillance. He went to get gas. Damien went to get gas at 1:30 in the morning at City Market. And so we see him get out of the car, pump the gas, you know, wait around, get back in the car, and drive away at 1:36 a.m. And that's the last time that anyone knows that he was alive.
I told Zach and Alexis about the timeline of Damien's fights at the wrestler's house and how the witnesses to the chokehold and the laundry room incident all put it happening around midnight.
At 1:30 in the morning, Damien's alive and well. Like, he's definitely not passed out at 1:30 in the morning. So what's been difficult for me is trying to figure out if he went back to the wrestler's house, back to the party after 1:30 in the morning, and then a second or third confrontation happened where he was ended up unconscious, where he was passed out, where he was put in this chokehold, and then somehow he ends up at Cabin Creek. Or the police have said that after 1:36 a.m. when he drives away from that gas station, their position is that he drives to Cabin Creek at that point and commits suicide by hanging himself in the middle of the night, which all of it is bizarre, right? But
yeah,
the biggest problem for me is trying to understand, where did he go after he got gas? Did he go to Cabin Creek, or did he go back to the wrestler's house? And that's what I really just can't, you know, I don't feel like I have good information on.
I mean, the dude wasn't suicidal by any means, okay? We were in college, we were all having a great time.
One of the last interviews I did was with former Western wrestler Elliot Copeland. You might remember him as one of the roommates at the wrestling house at 620 North Taylor Street. He wasn't too sure about me at first, but he agreed to talk, and we ended up discussing the ins and outs of Damien's case for over an hour.
He was like our little brother, and so we were all really close.
Elliot also has a hard time believing that Damien was suicidal.
I think maybe because he was on drugs or something, maybe he jumped to some conclusions about his relationship with us and just thought that it wouldn't be the same again, and maybe that's why he decided to take his own life. I don't know.
Elliot said his memories from the party in 2014 and the days that followed are pretty hazy.
A lot of the details that you even know about his death, I don't even know. And that's what's sad. And that's because we, as
put in this really shitty situation where we didn't know what had happened to our friend, and we assumed that maybe he had committed suicide when his body was found.
Just like he told police in 2014, Elliot was adamant that nothing happened to Damien at the wrestler's house.
There was all these, I don't know if you'd say accusations, or just people wanted to know what had happened to him, and we did too, but we didn't know either, and we were the last ones probably to see him, maybe not myself, but some of my friends, and so we were put in this really weird situation where we weren't even really told the details of his death. Maybe we could have gotten more closure if we would have known the details of his death a little bit more, or if it was something that we had talked about more amongst ourselves, but we didn't really. I don't know why.
Most of our conversation was Elliot asking me questions about what I knew from my reporting.
Did they ever figure out who he bought the drugs from?
Considering Zach knew about Damien's drug use, I was curious if he thought that could have had any bearing on why the freshman went to Cabin Creek.
Do you know if Damien was he selling weed and other drugs? Was that something that he did?
I don't think so. No. He's like more to just like buy a little bit and just do it. He would never, if he did, like maybe he'd just like get it for him and a friend or something. Why? What's up?
Yeah, just the idea that he could have gone to that location to possibly sell drugs and maybe...
Oh, hell no. Drugs were sold out in the open all the time. Like, that shit would not... You wouldn't drive out into the middle of nowhere to, like, meet someone to sell drugs. Like, we would just come over to my house, bro. And I'm just gonna put it out there, like, Gunnison is a wild place. Like, there's a lot of things that go on there that, like, wouldn't go on anywhere else.
In Zach's mind, his friend was murdered, and the people responsible have skated by for over 6 years with no consequences.
And then we kept just, like, being like, wow, these guys really did just get away with this shit. And yeah. It was kind of a belief throughout me and my friend group and a lot of students. I told all my friends, like, yo, this lady hit me up about Damien. Remember that shit? They're like, dude, no way.
I was grateful for Zach's candor and the way he talked openly about some pretty difficult subjects. I think there's strong evidence on all sides of Damien's case, whether you look at it through the lens of homicide or suicide. And that's exactly why I think we have to keep asking questions. Here again is Damien's father, Gary Hurd.
My perception is he's gone, and I don't get him back, regardless of how he left. I just hope that the truth comes out, and if the truth is that there was foul play, then those are people that were involved or held responsible.
As I went through Damien's phone records, I came across his text messages with Curtis Markham, the Western student who sold him LSD. In episode 9, The Arrest, we learned that Gunnison police arrested Markham and another student, Preston Claybrook, on drug charges before closing Damien's case as a suicide. I wanted to find out what Markham remembered about March 29th, 2014, so I gave him a call.
Hello?
Hi, is this Curtis?
Yes, it is.
Curtis had no reservations about talking to me for the podcast, so I dove right in with my questions.
Did you know Damien before March 29th?
No.
Okay. So
I didn't even know that even after he was missing and stuff, I was unaware that I had even actually met him or had sold him LSD until I got arrested for it. And then I looked through my phone and I saw that some kid named Damien had texted me and I met up with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That must have been a pretty big surprise.
Yeah, then once I saw that, obviously, it just felt like my heart dropped. I'm like, that's not good.
I asked Curtis if he could remember anything about Damien from that night, and his answer surprised me.
I remember he came over to my apartment, and he had a longboard And he seemed like he was definitely partying and maybe had been drinking already a little. And then he bought some off of me, some acid off of me, and then he left. And then he came back later, like, this is, like, once I read all the texts, I was like, oh yeah, I remember this kid. And then he came back later with, like, two other friends, and then they all bought some more.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you remember the two other friends that he came back with?
No, I don't. I assume it's people from the wrestling team.
This is entirely new information. The police report never mentioned two other people buying acid with Damien. And the tips they did receive mentioned a cross-country runner, not a wrestler, as possibly taking acid with Damien. But all those tips were second or third-hand information. And here was Curtis, the actual drug dealer, providing real intelligence. I wanted to see what else he might remember.
I just didn't know if you remembered anything about how they looked. Were they tall? Were they short? Taller than Damien?
Damien is pretty short, and I remember them also being, like, kind of short, like he was.
I mean, that's not in any of the reports. I've never seen that, and police don't know that, from what I can tell, and they never found who those other two people were. Because I'd be really curious who those people were and what they remember about the night. It's not in any of the reports, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like they all had longboards. I don't know if that's anything important, but that's pretty much all that I remember from...
Yeah, that does help, actually, just because the fact that they had longboards, I know that's something that he did with members of the wrestling team. The other information that was in the police report... There were several people who said that Damien was doing acid with a member of the cross-country team. That's something that came out, but they never identified that person. They questioned a couple of cross-country team members, and they were like, nope, wasn't me. And so they just left it alone. They never got to the bottom of it. But the idea that the people that came with him had longboards, that to me makes it seem more likely that it was wrestlers, not track people. The fact that it was around 7 o'clock, you know, if I look back at what Damien was doing at that time, he had gone to the wrestler's house and they were getting ready for the party. I don't think he was hanging out with any of the track kids yet, based on the timeline that I've been able to establish.
I mean, it's a long time ago now, obviously, but just, I remember he came back with two other people, and then I don't even remember exactly how much he bought, but it was definitely not all for him. Like, he was getting it for other people and stuff, too.
Okay, because that was my next question, because that was something I had thought when I saw that he bought it twice. I was like, who takes, like, more than one personal hit of acid? So that's interesting. You definitely got the impression that he was buying for multiple people.
Yeah, he was getting it for more people at that party that he was at.
All right, that's interesting. Do you remember, like, how much he paid for all of this? Because there's some question about money he had taken out of an ATM and what had happened to it. So I was curious.
Not very much. Back then, I don't sell acid or anything anymore, but back then, probably if you were good friends with me, I'd probably do like $5 for one hit. And then if I didn't really know you and you're just getting one, probably 10. Or if you're getting like five or so, probably do like $30 or $35.
5 minutes into my conversation with Curtis Markham, and I've already learned more information about his interaction with Damien than I found in the entire 187-page police report. It got me wondering, did the cops even talk to this guy?
You know, this case, there were so many interviews that police did, audio interviews.
Yeah.
And so I was able to get all of those. So it's been pretty interesting to go through it all. But you weren't one of the interviews. They didn't record the
interview. Yeah, they never interviewed me at all.
They didn't even interview you? They just arrested you?
Yeah, it was just they arrested me, like, on campus, like, while I was in class one day.
But they never asked you any questions about Damien?
No. When I got arrested, he asked me if I knew Preston. Yeah.
That is so bizarre to me.
Yeah.
They just arrested you point blank
they never questioned you about Damien's night, about, like, the questions I'm asking you about Damien.
No, they never asked me anything like that at all.
I couldn't believe that Gunnison police never interviewed Curtis, especially considering they used his arrest as part of the justification to close Damien's death investigation.
I thought for sure they interview you and talked about Damien and that they just didn't record it because they did that quite a bit.
No, I never got interviewed. I was just under arrest and they closed the case, I guess. And I don't even think he asked me a single question about Damien.
Gunnison police might not have been interested in talking to Curtis, but I sure was.
Did you go to the wrestler's party?
No, I remember that day I was just like, I went on a hike, and then I was just kind of chilling at my apartment. I think I had, like, partied the night before, and I just wasn't doing anything that day.
Okay, and did you know about the track party that was going on at Mountaineer Village that night, too?
No, there is always something going on.
Did you know of an apartment at Mountaineer Village that was referred to as the track house?
No, I didn't really honestly know that many sport kids.
I wanted to find out more about the timing of Curtis's involvement in the case.
When did you realize who Damien Hurd was?
I believe it was like when I came back to school the next semester.
Because he died in April. And so you think it wasn't until the fall that you had this conversation?
A lot of time went by that before I even was aware.
The timing actually does make some sense because the case wasn't closed until October. So,
yeah, that's when I got arrested.
It's interesting to me that Curtis Markham and Preston Claybrook didn't get arrested until October, when we know Gunnison police had information about the drug sale shortly after Damien's death in April.
If they wanted to arrest me, they would have done it a lot sooner than that. Was like, what, 6 or 7 months after it happened? And they must have known that I had sold him acid probably within a week or so.
Yeah,
I would think.
You're right. Yeah, they got into his phone early on, and they had those text messages very early on.
Yeah.
So, the delay is curious.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing was weird to me. I definitely thought something else has happened, and like throughout the years when I remember, I like type it in and I look for it on Google to see if anything has resulted in it, but I've never found anything.
I also tried to contact Preston Claybrook to request an interview, but couldn't get a hold of him. If you're listening to this podcast, Preston, I'd like to talk to you. We've already covered a lot of ground with Curtis, but he still had another revelation up his sleeve, and it involves the dean of students at Western Colorado and Damien's dad. According to Curtis, he was just a few credits shy of graduation when he was expelled from Western for getting arrested in connection to Damien's death.
The way they just wrote like articles in the newspaper, and like the police were making it seem like the death was my fault. Damien's dad, I believe his name was Gary, reached out to me, and he actually helped me get back into college. And so Gary, Damien's dad, and then the dean of students, Gary Pearson, so two Garys, both like had a meeting with me, and we're both like, we both don't agree with your arrest, and we both think other things happened, and the Gunnison police were kind of just using me as a scapegoat to close the case. And he had a meeting with the dean, and then they allowed me to come back to the school.
I instantly recognized the name Gary Pearson because he was the one who sent out a notice about Damien's death to Western students on April 2nd, the same day Damien's body was found. In that statement, Pearson wrote, "Police would like you to know that they are not pursuing a suspect in Damien's death, and they do not believe anyone is at risk." But according to Curtis, Dean Pearson expressed doubts to him about the case. And a lot of other people at Western felt the same way.
There was a survey they did at the school if people thought he committed suicide or if he was murdered, and it was like 95% of people said they thought he was murdered.
Popular opinion notwithstanding, Gunnison police closed Damien's case as non-criminal in October 2014. But that didn't stop the speculation, and Curtis said another Western student's death further fueled the rumor mill.
I remember, like, other things happening, too, like someone else that he knew shot himself, or supposedly also in the parking lot next to one of the dorms, and apparently he was friends with Damien.
Curtis is talking about the death of Daniel Posner, a Western lacrosse player who died of a gunshot wound to the head in November 2014, a few weeks after Damien's death was ruled a suicide. Daniel and Damien texted the night of March 29th. The last message Damien sent Daniel asked him to come over to the wrestler's house party at 10:35 p.m. It's unclear whether Daniel actually made it over that night. There's a lot to unpack in this conversation with Curtis Markham. We've learned that Gunnison police never interviewed Curtis, even though they used his arrest as the concluding piece of Damien's death investigation. And that he remembered two people, also on longboards and not much taller than Damien, coming with him to buy acid. Considering Curtis pled guilty to the drug charges, there wouldn't have been a conflict with him talking to police. According to Curtis, they simply never asked. Curtis mentioned that on March 29, 2014, he remembered going on a hike. That piqued my interest, because none of Damien's friends had mentioned hiking as something they were into, even though it's Colorado and most people are pretty outdoorsy. As we've covered in previous episodes, Damien's wrestling crowd didn't seem to be the hiking type, which only made it stranger that the freshman was found on the side of a ridge.
So you had talked about the weekend of the party that you had gone on a hike, and so you were tired out and you weren't like in a party mood that weekend. And that just got me thinking, because whenever Damien was missing, one of the things that people were talking about was the idea that he could have gone like on a hike or something. And so I was wondering, where did you go hiking that weekend, and where were places that you knew that people went hiking and did stuff in Gunnison?
I don't know exactly where I went on a hike, or even if I did go on a hike, honestly. But I mean, there's just endless amount of spots to like go. It's just like right behind the school, you could go out towards like Signal Peak. There's trails right from campus you could go on. And then, yeah, I know where Damien was found, but I had never hiked out in that area because it's kind of just like flat, open area. It's not really a mountain or anything.
Cabin Creek, where he was found, was that a place that you knew of anyone who ever went hiking there or mountain biking there?
I never have even heard of that. So, like, even you saying Cabin Creek, I'm like, what? What's that?
As I've studied the case file, I've developed my own theories about why Damien could have gone to Cabin Creek in the early morning hours of March 30th. The way I see it, there are two competing scenarios that I think are likely, and they both start the same place, City Market Gas Station. When I think about Damien getting gas, I see a literal fork in the road. On one side, I could see Damien leaving the gas station directly for Cabin Creek. It makes sense to me that he would fill the tank before setting out for a remote location. Damien, the kid with Fearless tattooed on his backside, wasn't afraid to go to the woods at 1:30 a.m. If someone invited Damien to meet up at Cabin Creek as a challenge after his fight, I don't think he would have backed down from it. But the other fork in the road is the possibility that Damien returned to the wrestler's house. If Damien did in fact return to the wrestler's house, then something else had to happen to get him to Cabin Creek. From my time in Gunnison, I learned the Cabin Creek turnoff from Highway 50 is a whole lot more visible and inviting in the daytime than it is in the dead of night. The only evidence we know for certain is that by 1 p.m. on Sunday, March 30th, Damien's body is hanging from a tree and he's not alone.
And I parked the car at the entrance to the Cabin Creek Trail or road.
That's hiker Linda Nienhauser, a Gunnison County employee who went to Cabin Creek and saw Damien's body, his car, and other evidence 3 days before the police did.
And there was a white full-size pickup with a topper parked right beside me. And then the black SUV was parked in front of the gate.
Whether suicide or homicide, once at Cabin Creek, someone turned the contents of Damien's SUV upside down, ripping through packages and unzipping every bag in that car, until finding jumper cables and a sleeping bag. The fact that Damien wasn't alone when he bought acid on March 29th, and he wasn't alone when Linda saw his body on March 30th, makes me further question the conclusion that Damien acted alone. Until we identify the people with Damien before and after his death, how can anyone have confidence in saying what truly happened? As I mentioned in episode 11, through my experience as a journalist, I've worked with experts in memory recall. I found one in particular in Texas who was willing to do cognitive interviews with witnesses for Damien's case. But in order to get that included as part of the official investigation, the Gunnison Police Department would have to reopen Damien's case and invite the expert in to do the interviews. I dialed up the Gunnison Police Department again to ask for their cooperation.
You've reached Chris Wilson, captain with the Gunnison Police Department. I'm either away from my desk or out of the office. Please leave a message and I will return your phone call back as soon as possible. Thank you.
You may start your message now.
Hi, Captain Wilson. This is Claire Sanimal. We met over the summer when I came to Gunnison to talk about my podcast on the Damien Hurd case. I'm getting really close to finishing up, and I just had a respectful request for your consideration. It involves cognitive interviews with two witnesses in the case, a hiker, Linda Nienhauser, and former Western student Curtis Markham, who sold Damien acid. They both remember seeing people who have never been identified, and I believe if we can identify those people, you know, we'll have more clarity about what happened to Damien, and we could put these rumors to rest once and for all. Please give me a call back when you get a chance. I'd really appreciate it.
I've always believed that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and hiding from difficult conversations actually makes things worse, not better. It's the motto that has guided me to follow Damien's story, wherever it took me. A journalist is only as good as her sources, and I'm grateful to every single person who spoke to me, both on and off the record, for this podcast. My greatest hope for Damien's case is that the Gunnison police would take another look at the final days of his life and reopen the case so that key questions can finally be answered. Until then, I don't think there can be any real closure on the case, and the suspicions and rumors will continue to linger. I believe that Damien's story deserves an ending, and his legacy deserves to be heard. The first season of Final Days on Earth may be over, but I'm not finished reporting on Damien's case. I'm continuing to bring in tips and talk to witnesses. I'll release more episodes when I have new information on what happened to Damien Hurd and who, if anyone, is responsible. If you have any information about Damien's case, we want to hear from you. Contact us securely at finaldaysonearth.com. Final Days on Earth is recorded in Dallas, Texas for Cold Case Productions in partnership with Podcast One and Live by Live. Each episode is written, reported, and produced by me, Claire Sanimal. Original theme music composed and performed by Riley Simmons. Songs licensed from premiumbeat.com are Bending Truth and A Thin Line. Editorial consultant is Lucy Scott of lucymedia.com. Additional production help from Amber Robinson, Janice Sue, and Elise Weber. Executive producers are Sharon Richards and me, Claire Sanimal. Special thanks to Chris Nowinski, Gary Hurd, Chris Allen, Ryan Pello, Matthew Murray, Zach Sorensen and his girlfriend Alexis, Curtis Markham, and Elliot Copeland for talking to me in this episode. If you like what you heard in this podcast, please review it on Apple and tell a friend about it. Thanks again for listening.